Yes, yes, it is.
Hi, everybody. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU LPFM, Lexington Community Radio, coming to you live from the north side of Lexington, Kentucky, in the historic 100-plus-year-old Johnson Elementary, now known as the STEAM Academy. Yeah. And that track you heard to start things off was a song called Daughters of Freedom, The Ballot Be Yours.
It's lovely.
Yeah, it was like a lovely track written by George Cooper, who was friends with Stephen Foster.
I know who that was.
During the 1870s and 1880s. So I thought it would be a fitting introduction to our show today.
What does it have to do with our show, Chuck?
Well, we've got some special guests in the studio. Joining us is Dr. Randolph Hollingsworth and Dr. Karen Cotton McDaniel, who are working on the Kentucky Woman Suffrage Project. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. How are you all doing today?
Very good. Well, I'm nervous, actually.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
Oh, nobody's listening. Don't be nervous.
Oh, no, I'm sure there will be.
That's what we tell everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
So can you explain to us just really quick, just to set it up, what is the Kentucky Woman Suffrage Project?
This is a project that came into fruition because of Jeannie Potter and Marcia Weinstein, who both were with the Kentucky Commission on Women, and over time have continued in their work for advocacy for women. And they approached me and said, hey, what are you doing for the 2020 centennial for the amendment of the 19th Amendment? And I said, okay, whatever. And we took the idea and ran with it. I was very, very lucky to have the support of hnet.org. Mm-hmm. It's the Humanities and Social Sciences Online Project up in Michigan State University. I'm the network editor for H Kentucky. And I went to those guys and said, hey, let's build a portal, a digital portal that would allow for open and free access to new scholarly ideas about the Kentucky woman suffrage movement. And they did. And we have the most awesome thing. I'm thinking we might be in the running for a national award.
Excellent.
New York called us up and says, hey, what are you guys doing down there? So have been talking to people about this digital portal, but that's not the only thing that we're doing. We have a digital portal, and I'd like to talk about it a little bit later, but we also have things like a traveling exhibit that we hope that people will want to take up and use in their local communities about the Kentucky Woman Project, about the Kentucky Woman history during this time period, and realize we're talking about a really long time period that women were working for full citizenship rights. We have
the 80 or 90 years, right?
Yeah.
For the full movement.
Well, I would say even longer.
Even longer than that.
That's true. So, you know, from really the beginning, if you even count the first Kentucky Constitutional Convention, David Rice was up there speaking about full suffrage for people of color, and this becomes an important argument throughout the rest of the 19th century. Mm. So Kentucky was on the line early on. We have a digital map that we're building that we hope people will help. We have biographical sketches. We have an annotated bibliography, and then blog posts by graduate students and undergraduate students that we're calling our KWSP fellows. We have teaching resources, a historical timeline as well. So besides the traveling exhibit, we hope to have a mobile app that we're doing in partnership with the Kentucky Historical Society. And we'll be launching our first attempt at a small sort of pocket museum of the traveling exhibit with Foster Ackerman Jr. and Eric Brooks over at Ashland, the Henry Clay Estate. We're going to do a gallery hop. This summer.
That's great.
So we're going to try and see what people react to when we have an exhibit up. I'm really proud that the Filson Historical Society that sponsors the Ohio Valley History Journal is going to devote a special issue on women's rights. And Dr. Melanie Beal Gowen is going to be leading up a panel just on women's suffrage in Kentucky. And then they're going to have the Kentucky Historical Society that houses the register. Mm-hmm. Will also have a special issue.
So there's a lot going on. It's a huge thing. And so Randolph, is this project kind of, you know, really identifying Kentucky suffrage sites throughout history and kind of connecting it to a nationwide, like a nationwide suffrage historical database in any way?
Oh, thank you. I love those leading questions because that was an idea that I
had
fleeting through my mind, and then it left as I was trying to talk about the other stuff. So, yes, there are several national celebrations going on at that same time. And one of the national celebrations is with something called 2020 Vision. And that's where Philadelphia and the Constitutional Center there will be having a big celebration all the year in 2020. And we hope to be there as well.
And what is special about 2020? I know, but...
Oh, I didn't say.
Just so people know.
2020 is the centennial anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which fundamentally changed how the Constitution was interpreted. Okay. And it also changed 100 years of interpretations about what it means to be a citizen. And this is an important thing for us all today to think about and to puzzle over as we look at what's happening in today's society. And the different...
was it still just property owners at that point? Was it to that late? Did this help change that so that the average citizen could vote in addition to women?
It was all women citizens.
Okay.
And can I read the 19th Amendment?
Thank you.
Oh, that would be...
The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation.
And it's real simple, but it was a big thing. Mm-hmm. And people have been arguing over that kind of statement for decades.
Yeah, and 100 years later, they still are.
Right. Exactly. So we could say sex, we could say sexuality, mm-hmm. we can say how sex is perceived. Mm-hmm. By the election official. Sure. There's all kinds of things. And here in Lexington, actually, we had an issue where women were indeed allowed to vote. And what happened in the 1890s, women were voting on school board election stuff. And my colleague, Dr. McDaniel, can speak more eloquently to this.
That's not my area. I specifically research African American women and their activities throughout the state, but they were a part of the process that took the vote away from us because some of the Caucasian citizens were concerned that black women were showing up in larger percentages, numbers, than the white women, so they thought they may have the power to sway the election. Of course, they really didn't.
But that was frightening.
That was the issue, yes.
The other thing is that they said black women and prostitutes were showing up at the polls. Wow. And they revoked. We were the only state to revoke women's suffrage in 1902.
Yeah. Actually, we were the second state. New Jersey did.
Well,
oh,
Jersey.
New Jersey.
For the record, it was New Jersey.
Yes. I have allegiance to both states. I was born in New Jersey.
Well, can I ask you, Karen, kind of throughout this whole movement, what was kind of the relationship or the juxtaposition between the African American movement for suffrage and women's suffrage?
Well, African Americans in Kentucky were, in general, actually, were primarily concerned with their rights related to race. Mm-hmm. So they were not always involved in a lot of the gender issues that were going on, because. Well, it's interesting, the conversations that were going on between the male and female in the black community was if the male got the vote, you know, the household had the vote. Mm-hmm. You know, we got the vote. Yeah. So they felt as equal to their men because they had been through slavery with them. Mm-hmm. They had worked in the fields with them and the tobacco barns and whatever. So they felt, you know, when we get the vote, mm-hmm. whether it was male, you know, it didn't matter to them.
Yeah.
They were concerned, though, because there were some women who were single, like Mary Britton, who in 1887. She was a doctor in Lexington, only black female doctor in Lexington, 1887. She delivered a speech on suffrage to the Kentucky Negro Education Association. And she talked about women's suffrage in terms of being a citizen, being a woman didn't really matter, and that we were all created equal. And if we weren't equal, then, that was a problem. Mm-hmm. But she said if they're married, they have the vote. Mm-hmm. If they're single, they should have a right as a citizen to have their voice heard.
Oh, naturally.
So whether they were married or single, she wanted the vote. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty fascinating. So I wanted to ask you all kind of how did this project get started, and how did you all build partnerships with the Kentucky Historical Society?
Well, we sat.
Randolph contacted
shop.
Me. Yes, Randolph contacted me. They had a hard time finding me.
And can you all tell us just kind of a little bit about what you all do, what your interests and your areas of focus are?
Okay. Well, I like I said, I focus on Kentucky African American history primarily, and I'm one of the editors of the Kentucky African American Encyclopedia. It's an idea that came to me when I was library director at Kentucky State University, right before I retired in 2005. So I focus primarily on African American history, mm-hmm. but I do concentrate very heavily on women's history. So,
tell them about your book.
Which book? Plug the book.
I just said
the one that's coming up.
Oh, the one that's coming up. Well, it's taken from my dissertation, which was called "Local Women: The Public Lives of Black Middle Class Women in Kentucky Before the Modern Civil Rights Movement." Mm. And we have women in there. You know, that I talk about women like Mary Britton in 1887. We talk about women like, you know, Lucy Smith, who was a suffragist. So there are a number of Kentucky women that people have never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and when you're
in fact, they know.
But they were popular back then.
They were popular back then. You could mention their name in the communities now. You could say Lucy Hart Smith downtown, and they say, "Oh, I remember Miss Smith." You know, the older people do. They remember them. So they were a force to be reckoned with in their black communities across the state.
And is a lot of that information that are you finding it difficult to find information that's written down, or is it all oral histories? Or
I like oral history on the one hand, but on the other hand, I shy away from it. Mm-hmm. Having been a librarian, I look for hard copy sources, and that's a problem that we've had. Is people write these articles that show up, and I better not call any names because Gail Publications may be listening, but they show up in some of these biographical encyclopedias, and so lay people can write those, or people, usually it's people who are at universities trying to get tenure, so they want to write an article and they want to get published, and they'll go on Google, or they'll find another secondary source, and they'll use that information. Well, they don't backtrack, because when I see a source that's secondary source, and it says they got it from this place and this place, I go back as far back as I can. So I try to find sources that are newspapers that were out there during that person's lifetime. Mm-hmm. So if Nannie Helen Burroughs is in Louisville in 1900 to 1910, then I'm looking through Louisville newspapers to find out what she's doing. And that way I can guarantee, you know, that it's likely to be more true. Funny thing is, one of my students was telling me, she was a former student, she was telling me just the other day that she's teaching in middle school, and the student was doing a research on Ida B. Wells. She typed in Ida B. Wells' name, and guess who showed up?
Who?
Harriet Tubman.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Harriet Tubman's picture on Ida B. Wells' story.
Wow.
So that's the kind of thing that's out there. So people don't follow up on the sources. They just take it at face value. This has got to be accurate. It's published. You know, it's in print. It's got to be right.
Mm-hmm.
But so many times it's not. I mean, and if you don't know black women's history, if you don't know the history of our associations, then you may have something that says the Association of Colored Women. Which one?
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a national association, and every state that had black women had an association. So there was the Kentucky Association of Colored Women's Clubs. We had over 200 clubs throughout the state.
Wow.
Over the time period from 1903 to present.
Mm-hmm.
There were at least 200 different clubs that affiliated with that group.
And what kind of subjects were they about? What did they have clubs for?
Anything that had to do with uplifting the Black community. So there may be a health club. Mm-hmm. There were one club that supported the Red Cross Sanitarium in Louisville. There were other clubs. There was a club here Lucy Hart Smith started, the health camp, fresh air camp, yes, mm-hmm. Where they would take malnourished kids during the summer, take them to this farm. They would feed them. They'd have exercises and activities and Bible study and all that for them. So that when they went back to school, you know, they were just as healthy as they were when school ended, because a lot of them didn't have lunch at home like they had at school. Mm-hmm. So,
This sounds like it might relate to our first guest that we had on. We had people for the stables. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about Lucy Hart Smith, because that's not a name that I know.
Oh, okay. Well, please. Lucy was actually from Virginia, and her husband, Paul, he taught industrial arts, and she ended up being his. I think he was a principal of a school, and she ended up being his assistant principal, and then he moved on to another school, and she became the principal of Booker T. Washington School.
Oh, cool.
Okay. And she was so actively involved. She was involved with the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs, and she served as an officer. And the funny thing about Kentucky is, you know, we look at Kentucky women organizing in 1895 when the Congress of Black Women met in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. There were two women from Kentucky there. Mm-hmm. Mary Virginia Cook, who later became Cook Parish, and Jackson's wife, Joyce Jackson, she was there, and she spoke. Both of them, their names are in the record because they hadn't, you know, they made a motion.
Yeah.
But President Jackson from Kentucky State, he brought greetings to the crowd. So that's the kind of thing that we need. We need to say, yes, they were there, their voice was there. That was before the club movement started. And then she moved on, Mary Parrish and Joyce Jackson both moved on through the ranks and became a part of the National Association. And before there was a Kentucky Association, they were already with the National Association. Mm.
It's amazing. Kentuckians revolutionaries.
Yes.
That's what we do. But just in case you're joining us, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU, Lexington Community Radio. And we're here in the studio with Dr. Randolph Hollingsworth and Dr. Karen Cotton McDaniel. And we're talking about the Kentucky Woman Suffrage Project that they're working on. So just to kind of sort out the chronology of the whole women's suffrage movement nationally and in Kentucky, can we start at the very beginning? Where did the movement get started? Where is it Seneca Falls, or was there something before that?
Before
New
Seneca,
York.
Yes, there were.
Be before Seneca.
Really, the first public lecturer, orator, is Lucy Stone, came to Kentucky in the 1850s to talk about women's rights. And in the 1850s in Louisville, this was a really radical thing to do. Not only was she talking about rights for all people, because she firmly believed that Black and white, she also reached out to Irish people, which was also unpopular in that time period.
Sure, yeah. It's like being Black.
She came to Louisville and spoke on women's rights as part of a human rights condition. And she was wearing bloomers. So dress reform is a huge part of women's rights. We have Lucy Stone speaking here in the 50s. But guess what? It was received very well.
Mm.
And then there's a campaign for backlash afterwards.
Yeah.
Talking about, you know, the fact that she kept her own name when she got married.
Oh, scandalous.
I, too, am a Lucy Stoner. Thank you, Richard Greisman. And but it also is because Kentucky was the first statewide woman's suffrage law in the United States. And it had to do with heads of household, women who are heads of household, could, because they were paying taxes, could vote on educational issues.
Mm. And when was that?
1838. And Lucy Stone came in 1850s and had a very good reaction. She goes on to form something called the American Woman Suffrage Association that continued to push for equality among all kinds of people, especially working class women. And, of course, we're talking all different kinds of people, immigrants as well as Native people and whites and blacks together. And then out west, also people of Asian origin. So this was considered a very radical approach, Lucy Stone's approach. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, who had also started up the American Equal Rights Association in the 1860s. By the way, we had a Kentuckian who was vice president of the AERA in 1867. Virginia Penny had written a huge sort of encyclopedia of woman's work. It was the first one ever published. Wow. And the British loved it, the Danes loved it, the New Zealanders loved it, but guess what?
I'm going to guess half the world's population really loved
it. The Germans republished it in German because it was so outstanding. And she has, of course, in there a suffrage chapter. Virginia Penny of Louisville goes on to become penniless, as well as put in an insane asylum.
Wow.
Where she died. But so it is something we have to remember. These are very, very brave people.
Mm-hmm.
So the first woman's suffrage association in the South is in 1867 in Glendale, Kentucky. And I went down just the other day to Hardin County and said, "Hey guys, where's that woman's suffrage club?" And they all went, "What?" So we have a big call out on our website saying, please, we need some help. And I want to thank my colleague, Dr. Doug Cantrell at Elizabethtown Community Technical College. He's going to get some people up to just do that work that needs to be done. We need names. We need dates. We need records.
You might check with the Kentucky Department for Libraries and Archives and see what the librarians can tell you, because when we were doing the encyclopedia, we would contact the library. The public libraries, before we would go to the county, contact Madison County Public Library, say, "We're coming down, we're looking for to do our project on African Americans in Kentucky. We'd like to find anything that you have on blacks in Madison County." So when we would get there, they were so glad to see us. They would have a room for us. They would have they would have piles of, you know, books and articles and stuff. Because it was amazing for me to see that there were the counties. All these counties were already ahead of us. Mm. They had already started compiling, pulling together these resources for the community. So we're a little bit.
Well,
more...
Hardin County is excited to do it. I didn't mean to say they weren't.
Okay. Oh no, I know they.
Nobody had ever asked
that,
them.
But
before.
I'm saying, but yes, contact. But contact the libraries, because the libraries they know where the resources
are. Good stuff.
And then you can also look at the state archives because they have records from all the different
counties.
Yes, they do. Yes.
So we have the first Women's Suffrage Association in the South, 1867, at Glendale. And it's continuing to keep going, even through the 70s, with 50 members. So it wasn't a flash in the pan. Then we also have, here in Kentucky, the first woman Medal of Honor winner ever, by the way. And she won her... issued into the Army in Louisville, Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, who goes on to become a very strong suffragist. But we get to claim her because she was here in Louisville when she was mustered in. And so we get the Medal of Honor, and we're going to count her. She was awesome. She would go around dressed up as a man, and everybody was like terrified of her. Mm. And she would get what she wanted because she was awesome. But anyway, so she went in full male attire and was often arrested as a consequence.
Yeah, wasn't that against the law for a while for women to wear pants?
Well,
she wore trousers as opposed to the bloomers that the bloomer people were wearing.
And there was a black woman named Kathy Williams who was a part of the United States Colored Troops. And I think she went on to out west. But anyway, she told him her name was William Cathay. Mm. And her brother was also enlisted. So they didn't know she was a woman for a long time.
Wow.
And so, dress reform is huge. And taking those corsets off. Because I don't know if you guys have ever worn a corset. But
not yet.
Not yet. I would recommend against it, especially the whalebone. It literally changes the shape of your
insides,
of your body, and your inner organs are completely damaged. Yeah, so these are things that you hear about southern women faint
painting.
Yeah.
Well, it could be because of the background forces.
Couldn't breathe.
So the first woman suffrage convention in the South is, drum roll, Kentucky.
Yeah, cool.
And that's the AWSA. This is the cross. Lucy Stone insisted it must be cross racial, and that's in 1881. And then the first woman ever nominated for a president in a major party convention is at the Democratic Party National Convention in San Francisco in 1920, and her name was Miss Laura Clay.
From now, Kentucky.
That, yeah, that's a name I've heard of.
You've heard of her. She's pretty awesome. And so the first statewide woman suffrage law then in 1838, a lot of historians of the women's suffrage movement continually brought that up throughout the 19th century. And this law was forgotten in the latter part of the 19th centuries, but Eugenia Farmer of Covington made sure that when the convention for changing city charters in the 1880s and 1890s, the legislature allowed for the charters to be reissued for second class cities, Lexington, Covington, and Newport. And Eugenia Farmer had been working with the black women clubs in Covington. So we often pay attention to the white supremacists who talk about woman suffrage. But Kentucky is a different story. We got to get our story out there because we really had a different relationship, I think.
Well, and after ratification, the black women in Kentucky took this their stand with the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs. Georgia Nugent, she was an officer. She's from Louisville. And she commented on the proposal that the NACW had to establish citizenship schools. And she said that the ballot without intelligence back of it is a menace instead of a blessing. And I like to believe that women are accepting their recently granted citizenship with a sense of reverent responsibility.
Wow.
And then she's followed by other black women in Kentucky, especially in Louisville. Mary Virginia Cook, that I mentioned earlier, she established the West End Republican League of Colored Women. Another member of that was secretary was Mamie Stewart, who was actually from Lexington at one point. She was Mamie Lee. And many other women, you know, were persuaded because of these women, because they knew them in the community, to go out and vote. And then a few months later, after the ratification, Annie Sims Banks, she was a black school teacher from Winchester, she was appointed as a delegate to the state Republican Party convention. She was the first black woman to become a delegate to a political party convention in the South. And she participated throughout the convention, serving on the Rules Committee. And she stated, "We are just beginning to open our eyes in politics, but before long, we're going to make ourselves felt." End of quote.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's also amazing to me that all these movements are happening concurrently in different areas, not only within Kentucky, but beyond. But nonetheless, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here with Chuck and Ben. And we're going to take a quick break real quick, but we'll be back here in a second with Randolph and Kara to talk more about this awesome project.
This portion of Lexington Community Radio's programming is brought to you by Mulberry and Lime. Since 2001, Mulberry and Lime, located at 216 North Limestone Street in the historic Matthew Kennedy House, provides an eclectic mix of home furnishing and gifts with an emphasis on bed, bath, and table linens. Mulberry and Lime is open Monday through Saturday from 10 to 6 and Sunday from noon to 5. For more information, you can call 859-231-0880 or visit Mulberry and Lime online at mulberryandlime.com. Lexington Community Radio thanks Mulberry and Lime for supporting true community radio.
This is Lydia Jacobs, host of Aging Adventures. We keep everyone up to date on what's going on in the senior community in Lexington, conferences available, how to stay healthy. We talk to a wide range of people, professionals, individuals who are paving their own way in the aging world. Aging Adventures with host Lydia Jacobs on Fridays, 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock on 93.9 WLXU, a Lexington community radio. But in
passing we'll grow old. My country, 'tis for thee to make your women free. This is our plea. High have our hopes been raised in these enlightened days, that for her justice praise our land might be. My native country, thee, grant us equality, then shall we see in this fair land of light justice and truth and right ruling instead of might, trust liberty. Our fathers, God, to thee, author of liberty, to thee we sing. Long may our land be bright with freedom's holy light. Protect us by thy might, great God the King.
Hey everybody, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU, Lexington Community Radio. We're coming to you live from the north side of Lexington, Kentucky. And with us in the studio is Dr. Randolph Hollingsworth and Dr. Karen Cotton McDaniel. And we're talking about the Kentucky Women's Suffrage Project.
Now, was that the two of you just then?
No, that was my awesome daughters, Rudo Griceworth and her wife, Joyda Bernardo. They're down in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
And Rudo is my daughter, and so is Joyda.
Great. And can you tell us a little bit about that song and also about New Zealand being and how that ties in?
Thank you. Yes. New Zealand was the first nation, full nation state to grant women full citizenship, and including enfranchisement. And the New Zealand has gone on to have all kinds of human rights efforts. The latest one is, for example, they believe that there's a sacredness to the earth. Mm. And they just passed a law granting personhood to one of their most sacred places in New Zealand, a river. So it is very fitting that my daughter is there and that they sang that tune. They might say it would be a tune of God Save the Queen, but it's actually a suffrage song that was used here in the U.S. Quite a lot. And by the way, the international community of women suffragists were very, very strong. And so it could have been sung to the tune of God Save the King at that point. But here we found at Western Kentucky University, the Kentucky Museum sent us the suffrage song that is to be sung in to the tune of America.
Wow.
So I really appreciate my girls for singing it for me to play on the radio today.
Shout out to our progressive Kiwi friends out there.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about the strength of the people and the networks. That, by the way, that's what a lot of people think when we do biographical sketches, that it's a bunch of individual brave people. Of course, it takes individually seated courage and a moral core to go and buck against convention. It just really, you have to have that. But you also have to have, just like that beautiful harmony we just heard, the connections across people of different faiths, of different backgrounds and experiences,
For example, Joyda is Filipino, mm-hmm. and was probably more pro-American when she was growing up. But when she got to New Zealand, they're Anglophile all the way. Mm. And so we see these many different kinds, New Zealand, Finland, all different kinds of women, the Germans, the English, of course, connecting with Kentucky women. So Madeline McDowell Breckinridge goes abroad, even when she's very, very ill and about to die. The connection of going to the International Woman Alliance is really tight. But, you know, they weren't just doing this and not having any problems. There were lots of problems. Yeah. And
well, that's a question I wanted to ask, because it, in retrospect, it seems like you should just be able to get stand in front of a podium and say,
do this.
Duh. We would like to be able to vote if you're 18. So what kind of arguments did they have to present? How do you
Right.
What's
and remember too, 18 as a voting age is pretty recent.
Oh, yeah.
So we're talking about 21 even. Yeah. So sorry, that's a historian in me. Sorry.
No, that's fine. It's good info.
But the
live fact checking, we're all about that.
Yes, that's what this project is about. Thank you. So I have, for example, and women are not agreeing with each other, and they all have differing reasons for being pro-suffrage, and they also have reasons for being anti-suffrage. Well, we're not finding a strong network of anti-suffrage. Mm. What we see is kind of an up-and-down movement here in Kentucky that is anti-suffrage. And there could be many different reasons why you're anti-suffrage. For example, you could be anti-suffrage because it gets in the way of another issue that you really hope people work on, and things like
temperance.
The Prohibition Party was nervous that they would be sort of edged to the sidelines if everybody starts arguing about whether or not a woman was womanly if she voted. You have to realize that the voting polls were out in dangerous places of mm-hmm. the city. Mm-hmm. They were all kinds of things going on, including, by the late 19th century, very strong-armed tactics, knowing who you did or didn't vote for. Mm. So gunshots, beating up.
Booze,
lots of booze. Yes. Yes. And with the booze comes all of those things attendant. And that's when you get the women saying, all of these things are why maybe we don't want to talk about suffrage. Mm. Well, and certainly, probably the most acidic male voice in Kentucky against women voting is Henry Watterson of Louisville. He writes some of the most horrific editorials in the Courier Journal, and just reading them today would make you wonder, didn't he have any female friends or relations? Why is he talking like this? So, you know, when Bingham came in after, you know, that paper turned right around, he really was an old, he was the New South, but he was an older voice about the role of women, especially Southern women. And they really tried desperately to craft this picture of Southern women as respectable, as the moral steadfastness of the nation.
Sounds like reasons why they should be allowed to vote.
And that's what people kept trying to go around and say that.
Yeah.
And so what I have to say now is that because there was this issue around the 14th Amendment that says that you cannot deny somebody the right to vote, to be a citizen, because of their previous servitude. And then the 15th Amendment, where you say, and it was the first time they ever put gender into the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Black men have the right to vote, and you cannot deny it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, for Southerners, in the midst of radical Reconstruction, this was horrifying. And so it gets all mixed up with race. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kentucky didn't officially go through Reconstruction, officially. And so Watterson is really kind of picking up on the Deep South's image of white women being in trouble if they mix with in any way, even just to go vote, mm-hmm. black men.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Although they had lived in their household throughout slavery.
Yeah, yes. Right.
Well said. Yes. Right. So white Southern women.
Ah, yes. It's like after we were given our freedom, then we suddenly became this dangerous entity. Mm-hmm. Yes. Not to be, you know, associated with. Yeah. So it's just weird.
It is a strange construction that you'd have to put through in order to assure white supremacy mm-hmm. is interpreted in the law.
Right. So in this period of time, what's happening with, are black women organizing against this?
Well, like I said, black women were more focused on racial issues, you know. So if the black man gets the right to vote, black women are okay with that. But they do want the vote. And there are some very strong advocates for black women getting the vote, including Ida B. Wells. She was in the North. She lived in the South. She'd been in Memphis and literally was run out of Memphis. Because she printed the truth mm-hmm. in her newspapers about lynching. And the truth was that black men were being lynched, and there was always this claim that they had raped a white woman. But when she went back, and she was one of the first investigative reporters, she went back and started looking through the court records to find out, you know, who had reported that they had been raped. And there were no records of any white women claiming to have been raped. So they were using the lynching of black men as a way of keeping them in their place. And her friends, she had some friends who owned a grocery store, and they were lynched because they were competing with the white grocery store.
Wow.
So when she left town. She wrote about, you know, this as, you know, this was not fair. They had not done anything illegal. And when she came back, she'd been out of town speaking. When she came back, they had burned down her press. And she was told not to return. So she was a wise woman, so she moved up north to Chicago. But she was involved in Chicago. And she came all around the country speaking. And she spoke in Lexington and Louisville. But she spoke in Louisville in 1896, right after the National Association of Colored Women's Club was formed. She spoke there at a church. And then she left there and went to a meeting with some women who wanted to start a Kentucky Association of Colored Women's Clubs. So she's actually a chartered member of like three Louisville clubs. Ida B. Wells, yes.
That's awesome.
And it's an important connection
yes.
that we need
it's
to keep.
Yes, she spoke out.
Up.
She spoke out, and even when they had the 1913 march in D.C., yes. She refused to be stuck at the back of the line. They wanted all the blacks to march at the back of the line. And it wasn't that a lot of the women in the North, you know, didn't support them, but they were afraid of offending the women in the South.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to put all the black women at the end of the line. And Ida B. Wells said she would march with the group from Chicago, or she would not march at all. And when the group from Chicago came by, she stepped out over into the march with the white women from Chicago.
Wow.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing.
Yes.
And this issue of lynching was a really powerful issue, and white women spoke out against it
yes,
as well.
Yes.
And DeShea Breckenridge with the Lexington Herald was a big anti-lynching advocate. He happened to be married to this most amazing yeah. Madeline McDowell Breckenridge. But there's an interesting first that I'd like to bring out because of that. Thank you, Karen, for bringing that up. In 1874, Mildred Summers Lucas of Owensboro became the first woman elected to a political office in Kentucky. And she won a special election in Daviess County for jailer.
Oh.
Her husband had been the jailer, and she probably had, they had six kids. She probably was an excellent feeder and jailer of all times. And so they
some
all
people
said,
might want to get caught.
So they she was elected after she had been appointed to fill her husband's remainder of his term. The reason he died and gave her the chance to become jailer as an appointee was because he had been trying to stop a lynching. Mm-hmm. There had been a young man in Daviess County who had been living in a household for a real long time. I mean, as long as this little girl had been alive, the man had been in that household. And the father got mad because he caught or heard that this black male, this young black man, was in the same room as his white daughter. And even though everybody else tried to stop it, it became, it just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and the poor guy was trying to escape this lynching. The jailer tried to protect him and got killed. And they went ahead and killed the black man in the courtyard, because you would lynch for, and they left his body up for several days so that there would be this sort of warning. That's how white supremacists worked. And then, so they appointed this white woman as jailer. And then they ran an election. She won the election against 9 candidates. It wasn't like she was the only person. She wins the election. And then the county judge, Atchison, refuses to allow her to take her seat because she's a woman.
Wow.
So, and everybody else was mad at the other candidates for running because they really felt she deserved this office. It goes for 2 years, and the Kentucky Court of Appeals turns it down and says she cannot be elected because she cannot vote.
It's undemocratic.
She couldn't vote, though.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And they said the 14th Amendment said specifically that women cannot vote. And they go back to the first article and they talk about a Kentucky constitution that says his, and it says it uses male pronouns. And so they say, well, they really meant men when they used male pronouns.
Wow. Well, and you mentioned there were a lot of people against it. Well, you know, especially the temperance women, but some of the temperance women with the Kentucky Association of Colored Women's Clubs, they believed that woman suffrage would be good because then intelligent, you know, right-thinking women would help elect the right kind of males to office.
And you and Randolph, you have an interesting poem that's a rewrite of My Old Kentucky Home, right? That kind of hits on that.
Well, no. That one is that Madge Breckenridge did a My Old Kentucky Home after we won the vote.
Oh, so
but the sort of terrible parts of this ideology about why Southern women, Southern white women, will ruin themselves if they get the vote. It was written in 1870 by Alice Smith Winston of Covington.
And this is anti-suffrage.
She writes, "When will women vote?" Exclamation point. And she's a poet, by the way, that is very, very popular in Kentucky. She wrote about gardens and lovely walks in the woods and
women
things, flowery.
Thomas Hardy.
So she is very popular poet, and she writes this just out of the blue. This is the only suffrage related poem that she writes, and she writes a lot of poems. When, oh, when will women, gentle women, vote? When the birds cease sending sweet songs from their throat. When the field-born lily learns to work and spin. Then hurrah for women, then and not till then. When the gold bee homeward with but poison hies. When the white-winged pigeon with the eagle flies. When the lamb's soft bleating changes to a bark. Then to women's suffrage possibly we'll hark. For when socks are mended and the baby's dressed and its lips like rosebuds to our own are pressed, when the flowers are watered and the birds are fed, when the fluted laces ripple over the bed, when the room is dusted, don't be laughing, when the room is dusted till no storms pass, through the bars of sunshine like some gate of glass, when the bird is sending from its little throat songs till even baby listens to each note, shoo fly, who could hit them there with such joys to vote? When the roaring lion bleateth as the lamb, when we call tornadoes but the day's soft calm, when shall men nurse babies and wear the petticoats, while their wives are shaving men and notes. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, that's complicated.
Wow, that's
it sounds a little violent, actually.
So it goes on and on. In other words, when Hades freezes over.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty much. So maybe can we flash forward a little bit, you know, so this is kind of what everyone's going up against and kind of both sides and, mm-hmm. of the argument. We've set up the history, but kind of a little bit further towards the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And, you know, you have Alice Paul and you have these big national movements happening. But what's happening in Kentucky and what's happening specifically in Lexington during this time when women are getting the right to vote and the vote's about to come up?
You want to do that? You want me to
do that? Sorry,
that's a lot of wins. And so Madge has done a great job. Laura Clay has done a great job. And, you know, there's this big thing, and we really have to work on it, the big thing about why is Laura Clay against what they call by then the Susan B. Anthony Amendment? Mm-hmm. Why? Why would she go out to Tennessee and say, don't do this, mm-hmm. don't ratify? Kentucky ratified, it was a mistake. But everybody's confused. Everybody's confused about Laura Clay's movements. But she is a very well-educated person, and she is talking about states' rights. She's talking about you want the local people to talk about this terrible change, this frightening change in societal norms. You don't want to just have the feds come in and say, you got to do this. So Laura Clay really is talking about keeping the discussion local and statewide. And she really pushed hard, as did many men, for a statewide suffrage vote before the feds. But Madeline McDowell Breckinridge is probably one of the best organizers of that time period, mm-hmm. to begin with. And she does very, very well in convincing both parties to go forward. And in 1919, with a new election of a fellow by the name of Edwin Morrow, who becomes governor by January in 1920, both the House and the House and the Senate have voted for the 19th Amendment, the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And the first day in office, Morrow approves that ratification. Mm-hmm. And so it was a big deal. It was like, you know, your first 100 days as president, well, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And here's his first day as governor, and he signs the Woman Suffrage Amendment. So that next month, Madge is invited to Chicago because they're doing these Jubilee conventions as the different states ratify the 19th Amendment. And she goes out to Chicago for a Jubilee convention of the National Woman Suffrage Association, together with this brand new association called the League of Women Voters, which was formally organized actually in February of 1920 at this very same convention. And she, Madge, was invited to speak right after the governor, Edwin Morrow, had signed that legislature's ratification. At the session in the convention, there was something called Valentine Evening. And it was a fundraiser to allow for women suffrage groups, because by this time, many men are on board. Mm-hmm. And to raise money for those local races. And so she comes to this Valentine evening, a fundraiser for other states' campaigns for suffrage. And she stood in front of a frame that had all these Valentines around it. And according to her sister, Sophonisba Breckinridge, who, by the way, was in Chicago.
That's quite a name.
Sophonisba.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
She was known as Nisba.
They don't make them like that anymore.
They don't.
Cool.
Thank God.
Well, maybe in my family they do. But anyway, Sophonisba Breckinridge writes about this evening. And she said that during her speech, Madge, that's what she would call her sister, Madeline McDowell Breckinridge, recited with, quote, whimsical humor, a two-minute parody on the state song Old Kentucky Home. And Sophonisba said that none who were there would ever forget, quote, how when she stopped speaking, all were laughing, yet all were in tears, and all rose in a spontaneous response to the challenge so gaily but so appealingly uttered. You ready to hear it?
Yeah, please. Mm-hmm.
The sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home. 'Tis winter. The ladies are gay. The corn top's gone. Prohibition's in the swing. The colonel's in eclipse, and the women in the ring. We'll get all our rights with the help of Uncle Sam. For the way that they come, we don't give a... And then they just did a little dash dash.
Yeah.
Whatever rhymes with Sam, we don't know.
The ladies.
Weep no more, my lady. Oh, weep no more today. For we'll vote one vote for the old Kentucky home. The old Kentucky home far away. And Kentucky, the 23rd out of 36 needed, was one of only four southern states to approve the proposed amendment. The other three are Texas, Missouri, and Tennessee. But it became law, and so you couldn't stop women from voting legally on August the 26th, 1920.
That's incredible. And here we are today.
Yes, and there's this incredible movie called Iron-Jawed Angels that shows just a snippet of all the agony that women went through to
about
get the
Alice
vote.
About Alice Paul, right?
Yes, yeah. That's really good. It's a great movie. I used to show it in my women's studies class all the time.
It shows.
It does. It shows where they were. Some of them were actually locked in insane asylums and, imprisoned.
Yeah, hunger.
Hunger. Yeah, hunger they went strikes. On hunger strikes.
And we didn't have, the cell phones taking pictures during then, but we had some photographs of the police coming out in those suffrage parades and banging people over the heads.
And that's one thing I wanted to ask
you. They call them ladies, but then when they're in the suffrage parade, they're treating them just like they're, riffraff or something.
Yeah, it's insane. I wanted to ask you all, since we're wrapping up here, first of all, thank you all so much for coming in and dropping all of this very important knowledge on us that I can't believe a lot of this isn't just commonplace.
We got a lot of names to look up when we get home.
Without a doubt, yeah, and there's a lot, and so
I've got a lot of tags to do when I put this up online.
That's right.
So many tags.
Well, I wanted to ask you all kind of, what can we do to help you all? Is there any information that you all are looking for or trying to ask the public to acquire, or can people participate in this project?
Yeah, how can people get involved if they'd like to?
Well, we very much appreciate partnering with local communities, community organizations. Karen has given a shout out to the libraries. I would also say thank you to all the historical societies that are stepping up to the plate. We can use in every county because we are sure that there was every county at that time period.
Yes.
So
and there are records. I mean, people have records in their garages. I went to a reunion of the Jackson people from Kentucky State, who were the first president there. I went to a reunion there, and I was talking to this gentleman, and I was telling him about my research, and he said, "You mean like the children's the Friends Club in Covington?" I said, "How do you know about that?" Well, his grandmother and his great-grandmother had been officers, and he had their records. So there are
in his home?
He's in Atlanta, but he had made a copy of the first three pages of their first meeting, the minutes. And I was just supposed to be there. A friend asked me to go, and I didn't really want to go, but I wanted to go out to dinner, so I went there on our way to dinner. And he gave me a copy of that. But there are records of these women. They have records. They wrote their own handwritten notes. So if anyone knows of anyone in their community who was involved, there are also sashes. We're doing different things with them, but the Historical Society had only like one sash. They have very little on the groups of women. So
they've got to be in people's garages.
People have to have these in their garages, their basements, or somewhere.
Now, if somebody listening has something in their garage, how can they get in touch with you to let you know that there's stuff in their garage that they need
contact
Randall.
Please contact me. I'm at the University of Kentucky, or they can look us up on Facebook, the Kentucky Woman Suffrage Project.
Great.
We also have a website on H Kentucky. That's where the network is, networks.hnet.org/H Kentucky.
Great.
Well, that's awesome. Well, thank you all again so much for coming in. I wish we had another hour to go over this, because I know there's a lot to it, and you know, we're just barely scratching
the
surface.
Well, thank you so much for letting us
be here. We don't know what we don't know, Chuck.
Exactly.
The unknown unknown.
And we know it's out there. It's got to be out there.
So if you've got, if you got some historical information about the women's suffrage movement in your garage, definitely get in touch with the Kentucky Women's Suffrage Project.
And if you missed any part of the show, we're on lexingtoncommunityradio.org. We're on iTunes. We're on SoundCloud. Is the app up yet?
It is.
Oh,
if you
good.
Have an iPhone, you can go to the
app
store.
So the iPhone app.
Search for WLXU. And
cool.
We've got an app. So it'll
awesome.
Have all your podcasts, all the live streams right there.
And this will be on again tomorrow morning, 11 to 1, right?
It is, yeah. So all thanks again to Randolph and Karen for coming in. We really appreciate you all.
Thanks for the invitation.
Definitely. And Rice-A-Roni University is up next. Nonetheless, have a great weekend. Enjoy the sunshine. And we'll see you next week.